Volume 1,
Number 80. Jesus returns to the mountain where he fasted and to the rock of temptation. A most beautiful dawn in the wilderness, seen from the height of a mountainside. It is daybreak. A few stars are still visible, and a very thin arc of a waning moon looks like a silver comma on the dark blue velvet of the sky. The mountain is completely isolated, that is, it is not linked to any other chain of mountains. But it is a real mountain, not a hill. The top is much higher up, but even from the middle of its slope, one commands a very wide horizon, because one is well above ground level. In the fresh morning air, as the faint white greenish dawn light becomes clearer and clearer, profiles and details slowly become visible, whereas before they were hidden in the fog that precedes daybreak, a fog that is darker than night, because the light of the stars seems to diminish and fade away in the transition from night to day. I thus see that the mountain is rocky and barren, split by gorges forming grottos, caves, and inlets in its side. It is a real wilderness, only where there is some earth capable of receiving and retaining the moisture of the rain, are there a few green tufts, mainly stiff thorny plants, with very few leaves, and low hard bushes of grass similar to thin green sticks, the name of which I do not know. Below, there is an even more barren plain, a flat, stony ground that becomes more arid as it stretches out towards a dark spot, much longer than wider, at least 5 times longer than wider, which I think must be a dense oasis which has sprung up in so much bleakness because of underground waters. But when the light becomes brighter, I see that it is nothing but water. Stagnant, dark, dead water. A lake of infinite sadness. In the still feeble light, it reminds me of the vision of the dead world. It seems to be drawing to itself all the darkness of the sky and all the gloominess of the surrounding area, dissolving in its still water the deep green of the thorny shrubs and stiff grass that for miles and miles around it and above it are the only decoration of the earth. And after filtering so much gloom, it seems to spread it around once again. How different it is from the sunny, smiling lake of Gennesaret. High above, looking at the clear blue sky, which is becoming clearer and clearer, looking at the light progressing from the east in deeper brightness, one's soul rejoices. But looking at the huge dead lake gives one a stab in the heart. Not one bird flies over the water. Not one animal is on its shore. Nothing. While I am watching so much desolation, I am roused by the voice of my Jesus. Here we are at the place I wanted. I turn round. I see him behind me, with John, Simon, and Judas, near the rocky slope of the mountain, where there is a little path, or rather where the long erosion of waters in the rainy months has formed throughout centuries a very shallow channel, a drain for the water flowing from the mountaintop, and which is a path for wild goats rather than for men. Jesus looks around and repeats, "Yes, this is the place to which I wanted to bring you." Here Christ prepared for his mission. "But there is nothing here." "You are quite right," there is nothing. With whom were you?
With my soul and with the Father.
Oh, you stayed only for a few hours.
No, Judas. Not a few hours. Many days.
But who served you? Where did you sleep?
My servants were the wild asses that came to sleep in their caves, where I also had taken shelter. My maidservants were the eagles that said to me with their harsh cries, "It's daylight," and they flew away to attack their prey. My friends were the little hares that came up almost to my feet, gnawing at the wild herbs. My food and my drink were the same food and drink of the wild flower, the night dew, and the sunshine. Nothing else.
But why?
To prepare well, as you say, for my mission. Things well prepared for are successful. You said so yourself. And my thing was not a trifle, a useless thing which would glorify me, the servant of the Lord. But it was to make men understand what the Lord is, and by means of such understanding, make him loved in the spirit of truth. The servant that is concerned with his own triumph and not with the Lord's is a miserable man. The servant who is anxious to make a profit, who dreams he will sit on a high throne, built on the interests of God, which have been lowered down to the earth, whereas they are celestial interests, is also a miserable servant. He is no longer a servant, except in outer appearance. He is a merchant, a trafficker, a deceitful person who deceives himself and men and would like to deceive also God. A wretched man who believes he is a prince, whilst he is a slave. He belongs to the evil one, his king of falsehood. Here in this cave, Christ, for many days, lived fasting and praying to get ready for his mission. And where would you have suggested I should have gone to prepare, Judas? Judas is puzzled and bewildered. Eventually, he replies, I would not know. I was thinking to a rabbi or with the Essenes. I don't know.
And was it possible for me to find a rabbi who would tell me more than the power and wisdom of God were telling me?
And could I, the eternal word of the Father, who was present when the Father created man, and am aware of the immortal soul by which he is animated, and of the power of free, capable judgment with which he was endowed by the Creator, would I have gone to derive science and skill from those who deny the immortality of souls, final resurrection, and also the freedom of man to act, attributing virtues and vices, holy and wicked deeds, to a destiny which they say is fated and uncontrollable? Certainly not. You have a destiny. In the mind of God who creates you, there is a destiny for you. It is the wish of the Father. And it is a destiny of love, of peace, of glory, the holiness of being his children. That is the destiny that was present in the divine mind when Adam was fashioned with dust, and will be present until the creation of the last soul of man. But the Father does not denigrate you in your position of kings. If a king is a prisoner, he's no longer a king. He's an outcast. You are kings,
because you are free in your small individual kingdoms, in your ego. You can do what you like and how you like. Before you and on the boundaries of your small kingdom, you have a friendly king and two enemy powers. The friend shows you the rules that he gives to make his followers happy. He shows them and says, "Here they are. With them, your eternal victory is certain." He, the wise and holy one, shows them to you so that you may put them into practice, if you want to, and thus receive eternal glory. The two enemy powers are Satan and the flesh. By flesh, I mean your flesh and the world. They are the pomps and enticements of the world, that is, the riches, feasts, honors, and powers, which are obtained from the world and in the world, but are not always obtained honestly. And they are used even less honestly when eventually a man reaches them. Satan, the master of the flesh and of the world, speaks also on behalf of the world and of the flesh. He too has his rules. Oh, he certainly has. And as your ego is enveloped in the flesh, and the flesh is attracted by the flesh, as metal chips are attracted by a magnet, and the singing of the seducer is sweeter than the warble of a nightingale in love in the moonlight and among perfumed rose bushes, it is easier to follow those rules and incline towards those powers and say to them, "I consider you my friends. Come in. Come in." Have you ever seen an ally who remains honest forever without asking a hundredfold return for the help he has given? That is what those powers do. They go in, and they become the masters. Masters? No. Galley sergeants. They tie you, men, to the galley bench. They fasten you with chains. They do not allow you to raise your head from their yoke, and their lash leaves bleeding marks on your backs if you attempt to escape. You either must bear to be torn to pieces and become a heap of shattered flesh, so useless as flesh, as to be rejected and kicked aside by their cruel feet. Or you must die under their blows. If you can bear that martyrdom, then mercy will come. The only one who can still have mercy on that revolting misery, which the world, one of the masters, now loathes, and at which the other master, Satan, throws the arrows of his revenge. And mercy, the only one, passes by. Bends down, picks it up, doctors it, cures it, and says, "Come, do not be afraid. Do not look at yourself. Your wounds are but scars, but they are so numerous that you would be horrified as they disfigure you. But I do not look at them. I look at your goodwill. Because of your goodwill, you are marked. Therefore I say to you, I love you. Come with me." And he takes it to his country. You then understand that mercy and the friendly king are the same person. You find the rules he had shown to you and you did not want to follow. Now you want them. And first you reach the peace of your conscience, then the peace of God. Tell me now, was that destiny imposed by the only one on everybody, or did each choose it for himself? It was chosen by each person. You are right, Simon.